Okay, John Pair stories. I first met John Pair under an interesting circumstance. I had a very difficult childhood, adolescence, and that's not the purpose of this discussion right now, but I got an emancipated minor status when I was 16, and, you know, I had this hotshot forensic psychiatrist, and just all kinds of amazing things happened, conspired to make that happen. And so I had at one point been living in the dorms in Madison, Wisconsin. You know, I was anomaly a freshman there, and there was a young woman named Lori Schnuro, a nice Jewish girl from New York, Chicago, and her, whose mother was a great beauty, and Lori was a total sort of dingbat, and for some reason she glommed onto me for reasons I never could quite figure out. Anyway, so she moved off campus, and then when I got this emancipated minor status thing that I was so pleased with, I kind of went around to everyone I knew and said, guess what, I'm free. So I just came by her apartment and knocked on the door, and she let me in, and she had her new boyfriend there. And within 20 minutes, he and I were off and running and totally ignoring her. She might not as well have been in the room. And we were off being unbearable to eagles alone in our area as we would be for the next 20 years. I mean, we were intolerable to be around, but we couldn't help ourselves because there was such gleeful recognition, like kindred spirit, you know. In some sense, it was little sister, older brother, like he'd say something and I'd catch it, or he would say something cryptic and hermetic and I knew what he meant, and, you know, hard to explain. So John Pair was incredibly witty, and I loved his paintings, and he would be delighted that I would look at his paintings and get what they were. Like, he had a very abstract one, and he said, "What's that, P?" And I said, "That's a road in the desert." And it's almost like he would say, "Very good," and give me a candy cane. he wouldn't give me a candy cane, but, you know, the glee in his eye, like, I got it, I understood him. And we'd have remarkable discussions about sex and emotions and say horrible things about people in general and humanity, particulars. And like, our conversations about sex were not a way for us to have sex with each other, because that would have been unbearable. But because we'd found a person who was worth talking about it with, because a person who had as complex a psychosexuality as the other person did and was extremely sexual but very fastidious, which you don't usually get those things in the same person. So we were unbearably great friends, and yet, you know, here he is, this guy, he's sort of the Wisconsin royalty, if such a thing exists, you know, came from money on both sides of the family, and you know, his ancestry is Luxembourgeois, Norwegian, and, you know, his mother used to date Leroy Crazy Legs Hirst when she was a pricky young co-ed at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And his father, I never got this straight, but his father evidently was a good-looking, smooth-talking son of a bitch who owned all these cattle ranches in Texas, but stole all of his mother's money in the divorce. I never got all of it. Anyway, so what the hell he and I had in common, I don't know, but it was just always inarguably there. And not to my credit, in those days, I was such a shriveled, damaged little creature that I took a lot of my self-concept from having this remarkable, magnificent creature as my best friend, you know, because I wasn't like this. So we had a really passionate friendship, and when he went off to take his junior year abroad, he went to Spain because, you know, since he spent his summers near San Antonio, Texas, his father's ranch was actually Archer City, Texas, which is where the last picture show was set, and it's the spinach capital of the world. They have a picture, they have a statue of Popeye right at the city limits. He was very into Spanish stuff, Hispanic culture, and he later told me, actually, that his father took him to a whorehouse in Ciudad Juarez when he was 15. Great thing to do for your son there, but okay. Shad, that's what he called his father. He went off to a junior year abroad in Spain, and this was still the era of Franco. I remember when he was getting ready to go, and I was so sad. And in those days, part of the immunizations they'd give you if you were going to Spain actually were cholera immunizations, which now they know don't work. And I remember how sick and ghastly yellow he looked. And we'd both seen Death in Venice, the movie, at that point, and we're really into the morbidity of disease. And anyway, off he went to Spain. So that January, I was in my little apartment in Madison, Wisconsin, banging on my door, 6 o'clock in the morning. I opened the door and there was John Pair. He'd come straight to me from the airport because there had been civil unrest in Spain and the Guardia Civil were mowing people down on their horses and it was terrifying and the University of Madrid was shut down. So the first person he showed up was me, not his girlfriend, not his parents, nobody. He showed up at my door at 6 a.m. So I let him in, we hung out, and their friendship continued. He moved out to San Francisco, I think in retrospect, really because he needed to come out, but it was also because I was there. And he was kind of getting nasty in his late 20s and early 30s, and in retrospect, I think what it was is that he needed to come out and he somehow felt he couldn't, which doesn't make any sense, but he felt that he couldn't. And I think when people repress huge aspects of their being, bad things happen. The last woman he was involved with was a really good friend of mine from high school. And I remember her telling me later on that, you know, they were messing around one day and he looked at her with this horrible look of horror in his face of like, "Oh my God," he said, "you even know how to touch me." Which would be, of course, his way of saying, "Oh shit, if I can't make it with you, then maybe I really am gay and I can't really be with a woman." So he and I would sit around in his apartment in Russian Hill and drink bad wine, and he would be nasty, but I would always keep coming back. And he groveled at tables at every place from Fisherman's Wharf to the fanciest restaurants, the Blue Fox, which was, you know, haute cuisine in San Francisco at the time. And his room was bare and beautiful, and he was always repainting it. And I remember the day he came out to me. We went to Dish, which is a now defunct restaurant in the Hate, and he told me he was out. And I was like, "But what do you mean? You're the person who told me that when you go to bed with someone of your same biological gender, it just feels so creepy to touch genitals like your own. What are you talking about?" And I wasn't critical. I just like, wait, this is not what you said. But he said, "Well, I don't know. I guess maybe I've always been this way, and I just finally gotten around to it." And really what it is he found someone he'd really fallen for, and the pain of maintaining that was just too difficult. And I remember noticing at the time when I met the first two lovers he introduced me to, I thought, his taste is the same. Doesn't matter if they're male or female. He still picks unconscious, kind of dingy, cute little brown-haired animals, which is just what he did with his girlfriends. It didn't really matter, you know. And he never really picked someone who was his equal. Just like that would be too scary for him. And so, you know, that's John Pair. And I thought he'd be with me till the end of my days. And he wasn't possible. He would create scenes in restaurants, but somehow he'd get away with it. People always told me how handsome and attractive he was, and I never saw it. I always saw the monster in him, maybe because I'm aware of the monster in me. And I remember a few times when we visited each other, like we shared a bed because we were roommates, but it just would have been inconceivable for us to have sex. Just, it was, would be too sibling-like. And I remember he visited me in Santa Barbara at one point, and, you know, I was happy to loan him my car. And he said, "No, P, I can't do that. That would be like having sex with you. I can't borrow your car." And I was like, okay. But we were kindred spirits. And, you know, he was that brother bond. And, you know, after we said goodbye, and I want to tell another story about him, which is earlier, which is that, you know, he's the sort of person, when the charisma was turned on, I mean, backstory, a woman he was involved with very briefly when I have a lot of people in my life who had linguistics degrees, which is very strange because it's a rare degree. But anyway, a woman he met named Adriana Busso, and her parents were Cuban refugees. Actually, her father had been the Cuban ambassador to France, and then he defected, and then her parents ended up being academics in Wisconsin. So he met her in a linguistics class. And so he had a brief fling with her, but it was just kind of, you know, friends with privileges, as they say now, fuck buddies, I would guess. But her cousin, who I never met, was actually supposed to be stunningly beautiful. I never met her. And John Pair, and I'll call her Lillian, but that's not her name, but it began with an L. They had this mad affair in Miami Beach, and they never had any money, and so, you know, they were living off of her, like, Neiman Marcus credit card, you know, and getting food at the restaurant at Neiman Marcus, and the waitresses would give them their tips because they were such a magnificent, beautiful young couple. John Perry always had these kinds of things happen to him, you know, kind of the waters would part when he would walk, to me, he always kind of looked like the bust you've seen of Beethoven, and he always kind of reminded me of a mixture of Malcolm McDowell and Mick Jagger, and that's not anything I'd want to have sex with. It's too scary. But, you know, maybe we're both possessed by monsters, and my monster is answering his, and I could never quite understand the effect he had on people, but I knew that he had it. And he is somebody, and I don't allow this to never allow this to most people, but I would allow him to touch me. Like, he could grab me by the shoulders and move me over here, and I wouldn't squawk. His older brother, he's a middle child. His older brother, I met him once, Sticky, he had nicknames for everybody, Michael, Mickey, Sticky, was evidently really gifted musically and was always cracking up cars in high school and had a raging alcohol problem and also had a drug problem and absolutely dissolute and was found dead in his bathtub after he'd been dead for 10 days. Not clear if it was a suicide attempt or just simple drug overdose. And so John Payer went back to the funeral, and the first thing he did when he got off the plane was come and see me at work. I was working in Emeryville at the time, and he got off the plane and he walked to my office, and this was 1982. Maybe I'd heard of something called gay cancer, but I wouldn't even go that far. And I just took one look at him and went, oh my God, he's gonna follow Sticky down to the grave in 4 years. And I thought, where the hell did that come from? And of course, that's exactly what happened. But, and so he and I went out to dinner with my then husband and another friend of his named Max, and John Payer tended to collect what he called cuddly Jewish friends, and I was one of them. And Max was totally tone deaf and adult, but, you know, became the food critic for LA Times. I don't know how this happened, but anyway. So we all went out to dinner, and, you know, John Payer and I were only focused on each other. And then afterwards, he came up and he hugged me and he said, if I can hug my brother, I can hug you. And it's one of the most found moments in my life. So, another John Perry death story. After I'd said goodbye to him in Madison, and, you know, I had a straight job at the time that didn't pay a lot of money, and I'd already taken a trip to California to see him, and I took a trip to Madison to see him, you know, when he was in the hospital, and I knew I'd have to come out for the funeral, and I didn't have infinite money, and I didn't have infinite vacation time, and certainly in those days that you knew someone who was dying of AIDS wasn't necessarily an excuse, much less someone who was a friend and not a family member. But so I had to be kind of brutal about it, and I knew I needed to save the vacation time and my money and everything for the funeral, because it was coming and I needed to be there. And so it was Labor Day weekend, and Friday night of Labor Day weekend, I got a phone call, and it was his stepfather on the phone. I gotta also say something about his stepfather, because, you know, one of the things John Payer and I were totally death obsessed, and he was the lead in the high school production of Little Abner, and there's a song in there which is like, spring is just around the corner, and he'd always change it to death is just around the corner. And we totally had the same morbidity and obsession with death. And when I think of the sweetest moments of my life, it's hearing him singing the melodies from Appalachian Spring as he's walking up the stairs to my apartment to see me. But anyway, I got a phone call. It was about 7:30 at night, Friday of Labor Day weekend, and it's Lyman Fraser, his stepfather. And Lai asked for me, and I said, yeah. And then Lai hands the phone to BJ, which is Betty Jean, which is John Perry's mother. And she says, hi, and I say, hi. And then she says, John Perry wants to talk to you. And he gave me the phone. Now, I realize I had another incredible phone call from him that summer, which is, I need you to get the Hemlock Society stuff for me, and I say, I'll do what I can. Now, this is pre-web, and so there was no easy way for me to get the information. And the Hemlock Society, because they didn't want people acting impulsively and committing suicide, they would make you write for the book mail order, and you'd send a check and you get the book, so several weeks would elapse. And by the time I'd gotten the book that told you kind of really indirectly what to do, he was back in the hospital. And once you get into the healthcare delivery system, you don't have a lot of choice. Anyway, this was the second phone call from the grave, beyond the grave, that I got from John Perrin. And he said, P, in this voice that was totally from the grave or beyond. And he said, you have to come now. You have to come now. And I said, John Perrin, I can't. We've already said goodbye. I've got to come out for your funeral. I can't come. And so we went back and forth like that for a little while. 12 hours later, he passed into a coma, and he was dead within 24, and I was the last person he talked to on the phone. So I went out for his funeral, and I made sure that the funeral had everything that he wanted: smoked salmon, blueberry muffins, the carnations on the coffin, and there are pictures of that, you know, all of us walking around looking shell-shocked. And as much as possible, I tried to ensure that the right people got the right things, but of course, everyone squabbled over him because he had that quality that I suppose of Elvis, everyone wants a piece, you know. And and as an aside, you know, it was very weird because his mother died that maybe 5 years later, and she kind of adopted me. She would kind of write me the letters that mothers write daughters, you know, and send me little Kathy cartoons, which I hated, but, you know, she was thinking of me. And after she died, it was weird to get stuff that was from the estate of, you know, Betty Jean Frazier, and it was John Perrin paintings. So I was haunted by him, and I moved back to San Francisco, and I ended up getting an apartment in Potrero Hill that directly overlooked San Francisco General Ward 5A, and his doctor had been the famous AIDS doctor of the time, Volberding, I can never pronounce it. I didn't plan to overlook San Francisco General, but I did, you know, because we had both decided that Potrero Hill was the place to live. So I mourned him and missed him and felt him moving away from me, and it was a year later. I was in New York and just missing him dreadfully, and some other things had happened that made me very sad. And I had the radio playing as I rented a car, and I was driving from Ithaca to Manhattan. I had work stuff to do in Manhattan, and Santa Cana was someone else. And okay, it's a cliche, but we're all out of cliches, you know. Like a lot of gay men, he got into Patsy Cline. But okay, you know, Patsy Cline is good taste. You know, thank God he wasn't into, you know, I don't know, RuPaul or something. So when I heard the song, I Fall to Pieces, I burst into tears. And I cried about his death as I hadn't at the time of his passing, and I kind of knew he was passing overhead, and I also knew he was kind of receding from me, and I missed him receding from me because I wanted to keep him close to me, but I knew he had to move on, and I also knew for my own development that it was not good for me to take that. It was okay for me to be alive on the planet because I had this wonderful friend, and I must be an okay person and artistic because he was. And it was only his death that I think, in some sense, freed me to create or develop in whatever way I needed to develop. And maybe I couldn't have if he'd stuck around. But I still miss him, and I've never met anyone like him. And it's really strange when there's a friend that I have in common, I introduced him, a friend named Jack, and I'm around him sometimes, and I realize how much he still channels John Perrin, that he took on John Perrin's vocal mannerisms, ways of understanding the world, physical gestures, but, you know, Jack is just the imitator. John Perrin is the original, and John Perrin had exquisite taste. Jack has none. So it's funny to hear this sort of puppet mimicking John Perrin aestheticisms when it's coming from someone who's got no taste. But I thought he'd be with me till I died, and he's not. And he was a brother spirit, and I met him when I was young enough that I could take somebody in that way. And his mom's dead, His younger brother died when he was also 36. All three boys died at the age of 36. And I haven't been back to Madison since his funeral. And I wonder who's tending his cemetery plot, because his stepfather, among his many business deals, was he owned the main new cemetery town of the crematorium, and one of his summer college jobs is feeding the bodies into the crematorium, and he and I used to talk about that. But I wonder who's tending it now. And one of the few, the only photo I have in my house is a picture taken of him maybe 3 weeks before he died. He was home briefly from the hospital, and he's in, you know, hospital gown, you know, so it's mostly white stuff, and he's in a wheelchair, and he's got that gaunt, he's already on the other side thing that cancer victims get and AIDS victims get. And he's doing a very John Parr gesture of putting his hands above his head and in a very temper tantrum-y sort of way, but because he's so frail, you look at the picture, and it's a spirit photograph. It's the spirit set free from the body. That's clearly what it is. It's ectoplasmic, though he would be the last person to believe in ectoplasm. So that's John Parr.